I Am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more engaging books to come out this season is the new one from authors Jeremy Hymans and Henry Timms. It's called New Power, How Ideas Catch Fire and Movements Build in Our Hyperconnected World. In it, they look at how power has changed and how technology has hastened the rise of platforms like Facebook and Uber, and how the movements of people can elect people like Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Movements like Black Lives Matter can gather steam and change the discourse. And both the Messrs. Timms and Hymans look at what's changed. I'm joined now by Henry Timms. I'll get him to tell us about this book and more. Henry Timms is executive director of 92nd Street Y. In 2011, he founded Giving Tuesday, a global day of giving. In 2014, he was named the nonprofit Times Influencer of the Year and one of Crain's New York's businesses 40 Under 40 in 2015. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Toronto today, Henry Timms. Mr. Timms, good morning.
Henry, please. It's very nice to be on the show.
Thanks for joining us. So I guess the best place to start is what's the difference between, say, old power and new power?
So, you know, old power is the way that we've all operated for a long time. You know, it reflects a set of behaviors where things tended to be quite leader-driven, quite kind of command and control. Old power leaders kind of thought of power as a currency. I've got it and you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're beginning to see is the rise of what we call new power. And new power isn't working like a currency, like old power. It's working like a current, something that flows and surges. And you see it really across our world right now. You see new power, which is kind of made by many and distributed, coming to life in all sorts of interesting ways. So I'll give you a couple of examples.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the Parkland High School kids and the way that they've mobilized the nation through using these kind of instinctive new power skills to spread their message everywhere they go. Then look at platforms like Facebook or Uber and how successfully they've worked out how to channel new power. They have this kind of essential ability, which is to harness the energy of the connected crowd, and the big platforms in our lives have got that. And then look at politics too. So whether you look at the Trump election or the Obama election, in both cases, you've seen politicians work out how to engage and free up the crowd to surge them into office. So the argument that we've made in the book is that what we all need to really now learn is a very new set of skills, these new power skills. We all know the old power skills,
right?
But those people who are succeeding now are those people who also know how to kind of conjure up the magic of the crowd.
Yeah, so you mentioned Obama, and I guess he's a good place to start in that the Obama we saw during the campaign, this one that really took off and that a lot of people were attracted to because I guess he represented a lot of things to a lot of people, was very different, the campaign version of Obama, to the one that governed. And I'm wondering how new power explains that, what happened there.
Yeah, I think that's a very good insight. And actually, you know, the Obama campaign was kind of classic new power. Think about the messaging, you know, we are the change we are waiting for. Think about the distributed funding. Think about the way people organized all around the country and how those micro donations eventually outflanked the Clinton money machine. That was kind of new power at its most exciting. For many people, I think the missed opportunity of the Obama administration is the crowd that brought him into office didn't transition with him. So actually, his presidency was a typical old power presidency, right? He you know, had some battles with other politicians. He won some, he lost some, but it wasn't a highly participatory governing structure. Although it was a highly participatory campaign. So I think one of the interesting comparisons now is you actually look Donald Trump, and obviously many people will have strong views on his politics and the direction he is pushing America. But I think if you look at his tools, what he has done, which I think is a lesson and from my perspective a sobering one, what he has done is he has worked out how to take his crowd into office. So the way in which he has used during his campaign, he so successfully kind of freed up his crowd and gave them agency and retweeted some of his most extreme supporters. He kind of this kind of fervor around his campaign, which has transitioned into his government. So the Trump administration, in many ways, has been defined by these surges of engagement around his his more extreme positions. And there's no question that that is proving effective in some ways as a way of advancing his agenda.
So taking Trump as an example, Henry, does that mean that new power has changed the presidency, has changed government itself?
I think it can. I don't think it always will.
I guess it's so too early to tell, right?
I think it's too early to tell. You know, I was speaking to some people last night about Justin Trudeau and asking for their perspective on that, which is, okay, what, you know, he on the surface seems to be very kind of new power, right? It's very participatory. The signal, it's always very kind of man of the people. It's very collaborative in terms of the image going out to the world. But the question is, in structural terms, is he governing in a different way? And the jury was out last night with the people I was talking to. There were, you know, there weren't strong views either way. But I think one of the interesting questions now is we've seen a lot of people work out how to send these very powerful signals around new power.
Mm.
It's much harder to create structures, to actually genuinely make things flatter, to push power down into a network and then out into the world. And that's one of the skills the book really talks a lot about, is how do you think about leadership in a new power world, where it isn't just enough to have a good Instagram game, right? That gets you so far. But how do you actually change old power structures so a generation of people who want to engage more in the world have more meaningful routes to participation? And I think that's the stake. Those are the stakes for government as we look ahead.
Yeah. So how did this all happen? Was it technology? I guess that's the key ingredient for new power, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, we've always had hierarchies, we've always had networks, there have always been kind of bottom-up and top-down dynamics, there's no question. But what's happened with technology is it's supercharged a set of opportunities and a set of expectations. So you think about when I grew up in England, and we had three TV channels, we had maybe four newspapers, we had a local radio station, and I wanted to be in the world of ideas. I thought I had lots of interesting ideas. And the only way I could really participate, and I remember sitting on my stairs, constantly dialing up the local radio station to try and appear on a talk show, right? And they very wisely filtered me out every time. But think about the barriers to participation that the generation, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, were facing. And look now at the opportunities that we all have to participate and the expectations we all have to participate. You know, look, everyone who's watching the TV in the evening, half of them are on a second screen. They're not prepared to simply watch what's being downloaded to them.
Yeah.
They also want to upload. So I think the truth of a new generation, and it's not just about young people, but about anyone who is engaged in these technologies, is they are having this kind of inalienable right to participate. They expect to shape their world. And the institutions in our lives can't resist that. They can't say, well, I wish it was 1950 all over again and everyone paid their membership fees and stood in line and did what they were told, right? That's not the prescription for change. The question is, how do you master this new power generation and get it going in the right direction?
And how do you get them to stay engaged, too? Because I find that usually younger people can get engaged for a little bit and sort of, you know, fall off.
I think that's true in some cases, but I also think we should kick the tires about the kind of the old power model of engagement. You know, there were lots of people who were members of clubs for 20 years who weren't very highly engaged. Right. You know, they went to their meeting, they paid their fees, they showed up, but it didn't, like, in many cases, bring them alive. Now, you contrast that to someone who is taking part in the Women's March or the Never Again movement, and sure, that's much more fleeting, but it's also more intense. So I think one of the interesting trades that we're looking at today is what is the benefit of intensity versus dependability? How do we think about those kinds of dynamics? And whether you're a local church or a synagogue, or you're a radio station, or you're a politician, you know, there's a new way of engagement that simply hoping people are going to turn up on your terms on a regular basis, that prescription just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. We're talking the week that Mark Zuckerberg is speaking before Congress, and I guess Facebook and this whole Cambridge Analytica thing is a good place to look at technology and how, I guess, it can get screwed up because a lot of people are talking about how they feel about Facebook in recent weeks. How could we say share in the value that we've created with our Facebook accounts, or do you think that's possible looking ahead?
I think that's a really important. I think it's actually a really important moment, because Facebook is an example of an organization who has built the best new power machine ever built. Right, think of the billions of people who participate and share their own views and opinions and likes on a daily basis. And the language they use is always about the power to share and about community and about connectedness. But although they have a new power model, they actually have quite old power values as an institution. You know, the value, just as you point out, the value is centralized. The governance is really a very small number of people make decisions that affect our daily lives, our choices, and our elections. Mm-hmm. We have no real glimpse into the algorithm which shapes how we're behaving. So I think the problem Facebook has right now is it became so huge because people wanted to participate. And now what's happening is people are developing more of a political consciousness around the cost of that participation. You know, Cambridge Analytica, in a way, was the kind of canary in the coal mine, that people suddenly realized it wasn't about Cambridge Analytica per se. It was about the fact that every day you and I are donating all of this data to Facebook, and people are beginning to feel like that relationship is pretty badly imbalanced, uh-huh. and it's pretty transactional. So your second question, which is kind of what next, gets us, I think, to a really interesting set of questions for us all, is how might we reimagine something like Facebook? So here are a couple of ideas that we've put in the book, which I think are worth some more investigation. The first is, how would we think about a public interest algorithm? So, you know, we know about public interest television, you know, the public interest test in broadcasting. Uh-huh. What would a public interest algorithm look like? What would an algorithm look like that was tweaked to serve our public interest? And to go a bit further with that, what would an algorithm look like where you and I could choose to dial things up and dial things down, to bring in views of people we disagree with, to make sure we're getting more fact-based information? You know, these things are technologically possible. So I think there's an interesting set of kind of reimaginations of the algorithm. But the most interesting piece of work that I've researched recently is actually what Tim Berners-Lee is doing. So, you know, the father of the World Wide Web. He was worried years ago. He wrote a paper in 2008, which was predicting that all of these, you know, distributed social networks would centralize power in very meaningful ways. And so he's working on something called interoperability, which I think people are going to start talking about a lot more. Mm. And interoperability is this idea. If you imagine that all of your data is like a suitcase, you carry your suitcase with you. And right now, if you take your data, you know, you take your data to Facebook, your data is essentially inside Facebook. It can't travel anywhere else very easily. The idea of interoperability is you own your data and then you lease it out to companies like Facebook until you go to another platform. And it would make life much easier because we would all be able to move from platform to platform to platform with our own data. And it would also make life fairer, because in those scenarios, the data is ours. We would be thoughtful about which companies we lent it to, and then we would be able to take it away at the end of our interaction. So I think there's a really interesting set of conversations coming beyond kind of delete Facebook.
Right.
I think there's a conversation about reform Facebook coming, and I think there's a conversation about replace Facebook.
Yeah, a guy like Zuckerberg, though, is unlikely to cede control or profit. So in the meantime, deleting one's account, I guess, I mean, do you think that sends a message to someone like him or people that wield the currency of old power, say?
100%. I mean, there's a reason. These dynamics are not new. Like, people have been aware for years, obviously, about the kind of imbalance of power at Facebook. But it's become very public very quick, and it's no surprise that the new power, which got behind delete Facebook, helps actually support the old power, which means Zuckerberg is in front of politicians having to explain himself, right? There's a real dynamic happening between those two forces. So I think there's definitely all of us as users of Facebook. I think the awareness which is coming up around our rights as Facebook users is really important. And one of the things that we try and get into in the book is to say, like, all of us have to learn these new power skills. If the only people who are really good at new power are the people who oversee the big platforms in our lives, we're not going to end up being more powerful. So I think the question for us all is, how do we think about structural questions like these? How do we think about spreading our ideas? How do we think about leadership? Those are the critical skills of the 21st century, and it's time for all of us to take those skills into our own hands.
Now, has our relationship to authority, has that changed a great deal, do you think, in this sort of interregnum that we're in?
I think it definitely has, in two interesting ways. So one is, there are, and to many this is a big surprise, but actually, you know, authoritarianism and kind of the strong man who we expected to have disappeared, right? Everyone was predicting the strong man had sort of ended in the 20th century and everything would be democratized. You're seeing these strong men come back in a way stronger than ever because what they're doing is they're working out how to supercharge their authoritarian tendencies with more participatory societies. And that's a really dangerous blend because the strong men we're seeing succeeding in the world, we call them the new power strongman. So the new power strongman isn't like Big Brother. So Big Brother was powerful in the way Kim Jong-un is powerful, in the sense that he could control everything. It was a very old power set of skills. You know, he could control all the media. There was one truth. There was one set of channels. Everyone had to do as they were told. It was very much a compliance-based idea. Think how different that is from someone like President Xi in China. Uh-huh. Now, China is fascinating because it's a highly participatory society. People are online a lot, they're engaged, they're organizing shopping, they're involved in culture, there's a lot of enthusiasm around entrepreneurship and makers. You know, it feels a very vibrant and kind of engaged and collaborative society in one way, but not politically. So the interesting development in China is people are being encouraged to participate in lots of ways, but they have ring-fenced a set of political activities that would threaten the regime. And so I think as we look forward, again, this I think points towards the stakes for all of us, which is whoever mobilizes best is going to win, right? If everyone expects to participate more, the people who provide those routes to participation are going to come out on top. At the moment, the people who are doing that really well are the platforms and the strongmen.
Yeah.
What needs to happen next is the institutions in our world, the academy, universities, libraries, local government, media, all of the institutions of our world need to get so much better at new power, because if they can't provide paths to meaningful participation, other people will take their place.
Yeah, not just strongmen. I mean, you know, we thought the science was settled on climate, vaccinations, racism even. I mean, you're seeing a rise in say, you know, racists and white supremacists online. And I guess that speaks to these are sort of bad actors and their ability to know how to use new power.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think they also, there's a reason that the anti-vaxxers can often spread their messages better than the health officials, or that the climate deniers can do it better than the climate scientists. And there was research recently which showed that actually it's easier for fake news to spread than the truth, right? The truth actually starts at a disadvantage. People used to say, you know, if you have truth on your side, you're going to win.
Right.
The research suggests actually if you have falsehood on your side, you're starting further down the track. So the question then becomes, how do you spread your ideas in a new power world? And one of the things we talk about in the book is that there are three kind of simple characteristics of if you want your ideas to spread in a new power world, how you do it. And the first, and let's use an example like the Me Too movement, right? The Me Too movement is phenomenal, something we've admired enormously and spread all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It had three key components to it. The first, it was actionable. It told people, you know, Me Too, you will be able to do something by taking part in this campaign and adding your own testimony. The second thing, it was connected, right? You were connected to this peer community of people all around the world who were sharing their stories. And by telling your story, you strengthened it. You strengthened the whole movement. You were part of this sideways new power community going around the world. And the third thing is, it was an idea that was extensible. It was an idea that could actually transform as it moved around the world. So the Me Too movement in the US became, in France, renounce your pig. So they changed the frame entirely, but they kept the spirit. And so one of the great skills, I think, of the 21st century, and this is so true if you're a climate scientist or a health official, is if you're coming into the world with your kind of old power skill set, you've got your press release, you've got your peer-reviewed paper, you know, you're not going to be able to compete in a world where people are spreading ideas via memes, via emojis, via kind of very highly sophisticated social media campaigns. And so the place to start with a lot of this work is getting those people on the side of the angels to really to start to master new power skills, like how you spread your ideas.
Yeah, yeah. One review of the book by someone you know, Micah Seifrey, asks, yeah. It's a favorable review, but he asks at the end of it, as we're demanding greater accountability, are the people who have this new power, are they ones that have not been at the table before, or has it just been, say, reshuffled into new hands? And as such, it's really old power with new faces, if you will.
I think that's right, and actually worse than that, it's old power with better algorithms. That's actually the big danger. Now, I think we end up more optimistic on this, although I think we think the stakes are high, which is there is a real danger that this era of participation, all of us, you know, furiously participating every day, there is a real danger that all we're doing is creating value for others, right? Or that we're in some ways actually distracting ourselves from some of the kind of democratic principles that we all stand for. So I think there's a real danger in that. Having said that, what we saw with this book, as we researched it around the world, is story after story of people who are finding out ways of taking power back into their own hands. So I'll tell you one of the most inspiring stories we heard was of a group of nurses in the Netherlands. And they had got fed up. Yeah. They were fed up of being always at the bottom of the totem pole. They were being told they were spending too much time with their patients. They always were following all this bureaucracy and procedures. So they set up their own nursing service, and they said, we're going to get into groups of 10 people, are going to go out into the field and form their own teams and choose their own locations and find their own patients and make their own decisions. And it became this amazing kind of decentralized, distributed approach to community nursing. And today they have over 15,000 nurses across the Netherlands. They're the largest provider of community health nursing in the country. And all of those 15,000 nurses are looked over by a central team of about 50 people at head office. Only 50 people at head office. And the 50 people at head office, their job is to get problems out of the way of the nurses so the nurses can get on and do the work they need to do. And what's so fascinating about this model is they're all connected by what they call nurse-friendly software. Mm-hmm. So if there's a member, a nurse, and he wants to learn more about Alzheimer's, he can reach out and find other nurses across the country who had a lot of expertise in that. So they share knowledge in this kind of collaborative new power way, but they all have this high degree of agency. And two things have happened which are exciting about this work. The organization is called BERTSORG. One is they are getting better health outcomes. And two is they're actually spending less time with patients because the efficiency is so much higher. And so you can travel the world, and the book is full of these kinds of stories, where what you start to see is those organizations who are really trying to work out what new power is and how they can push power down into their networks and out into the world, those stories are everywhere. We just need to encourage many more to step up and start experimenting in these kinds of new power ways.
This is such an engaging, fascinating book. And as you said, there are dozens of stories like that in this book. I guess other than bring them to us for the first time for a lot of readers, you've started a conversation here, both you and Jeremy. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book, Henry.
I'm very grateful.
The book is called New Power, How Ideas Catch Fire and Movements Build in Our Hyper-Connected World. It's published by Random House. One of its authors, Henry Timms, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.